Nick, just say whatever you're going to say as a goodbye so I can splice that in.
Oh, okay. You mean like just say...
Even if you just say
like
goodbye.
Like I just
see
said.
See you later, okay, or whatever. Work or in the shop. Bye, everybody, or whatever you want to say.
Later, guys.
That felt so fake.
if people only knew.
Later, guys.
Later, guys.
That's later, guys.
That was good. I liked it. It was perfect.
It was perfect. Hi, everybody. This is the Craft Will Never Die podcast. My name is Blake Weber, and I'm joined by Nick Key, also known as Key Woodworks, and Jason Hibbs, also known as Bourbon Moth Woodworking. You can find me at The Weber Woodshop. All three of us are on YouTube and Instagram, but you can find us collectively at Craft Will Never Die on Instagram. We're excited to jump right into episode number 3, so what is going on, guys?
What's up, fellas?
Hey, hey, hey!
Hey, guess what?
What?
I'm sitting at my brand new maple slab desk.
No.
No, really?
Prove it.
Can you not see it?
Describe it to us.
I can see a tiny little corner, but it looks very IKEA-ish to me from where I sit.
The jig is up. It's actually just an IKEA table.
So you're the camera guy, so I just assume everything you do is just like CGI.
It's all just smoke and mirrors over here.
Is that an IKEA slab? Is what do they call that? Like slab or something with the two dots over the A or slab A?
Did it only come with half the parts you need to put it together?
It actually came with extra parts.
Okay, then yep, that's IKEA. Perfect.
Yeah, totally fine. A lot of
so
Allen
you're
keys.
Sitting at the desk. How's
I'm sitting
it feel?
At my desk. Oh, it's great. The belly cutout is perfect for my dad bod. Like it's. Yes. I mean, this slab could not have been made any better for my body type. Mm. I mean,
custom
it's,
made.
Yes.
Just like Nick, thick and full of burls.
And lots of figure.
A lot of figure. Yeah, I've been working on my figure.
Yeah?
Woo. I'm getting fat, guys. I need to start working out again. I used to work out a lot in college, and I haven't done that since college.
I feel like that's what every guy says. Oh, I used to work out in college.
Yeah. No, I did. I mean, I played baseball in college, so it was like a requirement to work out. So,
what about all those calories you burn pushing that hand plane back and forth over that slab?
Well, that wasn't too many since I only made 2 passes. But actually, I got out in the shop this past week just to get the number 7 plane out and make some shavings. I don't know if you guys saw it on Instagram this past couple. It's been probably like 3 or 4 days now. William Walker
and Katz Moses.
Oh yes,
Jay Katz Moses were going at it with their shavings back and forth. It was
the
epic.
Best Instagram feud ever.
Yeah, it was awesome. Well, they totally inspired me just to go out in the shop one day and just make some shavings. I don't think I got near as thin as what they were putting up, but it was just a good time to get out in the shop and get the old plane warmed up and burn some calories.
Just go for it. So the desk is done. What are you doing in the shop now other than just making shavings? You got any projects going on?
Yeah, I finally got back out in the shop today. Went over and picked up some plywood and making a... it's hard to say what it actually is because it's kind of like a multi-station coffee bar / refrigerator cabinet. So like, there's going to be a mini fridge that goes on one side underneath the coffee bar.
Is this for your house or for the man cave?
No, this is actually for a client. So this is a client build.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so the guy is, he owns a mechanic shop, and this is going to go in his mechanic shop. So it'll be like a coffee bar, and it'll have the mini fridge with waters and Cokes and stuff like that for the customers. It'll be in their lobby.
Oh, okay, so when you brought up last time.
Yeah. It's that one. I'm finally getting started on it. So I got all the plywood picked up today, and I got all the components cut this afternoon, and then I spent like 2.5-3 hours edge banding all of it, which is...
Aches.
It's a lot of fun. Not really. But it's really not that bad. Have you guys iron-on edge band at all?
I never have.
No, I haven't. I always just cut strips of like quarter-inch hardwood and...
That's what I've tried too, yeah.
So you do it like the really nice way.
Well, I just don't have an iron. Well, my wife, I don't want to sound sexist, but we as a family have one.
Right.
But I don't know that I'm allowed to take it out to my shop.
Cover it with glue.
Yeah. So
I have a dedicated shop iron just for iron-on edge banding.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you do it a lot.
I don't do it a ton, but I do it enough to where I went. I mean, I actually picked up this iron at Lowe's. So it was like a $10 Black & Decker iron. That was just like
for edge banding, or is
no,
it just
no,
iron?
No. It's just strictly a clothes iron.
Have you ever seen anybody use an edge banding iron? Is that a thing? Because I've only ever seen people use like Black & Decker, or like, you know, household irons.
They make those ones with the little foot, I think.
Really?
The iron is it's only like a few inches long. Huh. I've seen those, but I've never actually used one.
No, I haven't seen that. I mean, I know Festool has one that does all of it all together.
And heats it up at the
same
time.
Yeah, it's like an all-in-one machine that
probably slices it right behind where after it glues it on, yeah.
I mean, it probably builds your whole cabinet for you after you're done with it, too.
Probably.
Yeah, and it's only $8,000.
Right, if it's on sale.
That's a steal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's really not that bad.
What kind of plywood are you using?
This one is just simple birch plywood. I wanted to do Baltic birch, but my supplier for that is only open Monday through Friday, and just the job doesn't let me get out all the time so I can go pick that up. And then on top of that, it's only in 5-foot by 5-foot sheets, and I have to borrow a buddy of mine's truck to go get it because there's no way I can put that in the back of my Flex because 5 foot is just enough.
5 by 5 sheets are so annoying because, like, my arm span, I'm not a huge guy. It, like, barely reaches that 5 by 5, you know, span. And so when I'm carrying a sheet around, it's taken everything I have to, like, get my arms around that.
You know,
crazy.
You know what you should get?
Longer arms?
Yes. But on top of that, they have this thing called a Gorilla Gripper.
I have one of those.
Yeah, well, that's what I use to get plywood around, and it's made my life so much easier.
Well, yeah, but if I use that to carry plywood around, then there's going to be an empty spot on my shelf while I'm moving plywood around. And that just doesn't work.
You won't have to be moving plywood too far once you get the plywood mail slot in your garage.
Yeah,
that's right.
The mail slot.
Just open it.
No,
right
I'm
up.
With you, though. Those 5 by 5 sheets are annoying, especially with hauling them around. Because, yeah, like a truck bed and everything. My truck bed's 5 feet wide exactly. So, I mean, I can put one in there, but it, like, fits snug. It's a pain to get in and
right.
out.
Yeah, I borrow my buddy's F-150, who it's exactly 5 foot wide, so the sheet fits right on top of the wheel wells. So, I mean, it's like there's no wiggle room, which is fine.
Yeah, that's what I have, yeah.
It's perfect.
All right, so before we move on, just a quick word from our sponsor. Jason, what do you got for us this week?
All right, well, this week's sponsor is Lipoplane. Do you like drinking beer but hate that nasty beer belly? Well, Lipoplane has the solution. Lipoplane quickly and easily attaches to any standard shop planer. All you do is attach the Lipoplane, set your desired waist size, and climb right in. Lipoplane will quickly and easily remove any unwanted belly fat. Now, they say that beauty comes with a cost. Well, we guarantee Lipoplane will be excruciatingly painful, but it will give you that slim down figure that you've always wanted. Lipoplane, get yours today.
Nick, what were you saying about that figure that you should not use this product because you kind of fit your new table perfectly there, your desk?
No, I'm signing up. I'm getting one ASAP.
That's perfect. All right. Well, thank you, Jason.
Yeah, I've heard it's great.
All right. So how much have you gotten done on that project then?
Well, I spent a lot of time this afternoon edge banding, like I said, and then I threw everything through the Craig Foreman and just pocket holed everything. So I spent probably like the last 30 minutes before we hopped on here to record, and I got the main frame together. So the whole carcass is together in the shop now.
Are you just doing like a clear coat on it, or are you going to stain it, or what's your plan, paint?
So I'm going to be using India ink and ebonizing it.
Oh, cool.
Ooh.
So he wanted it black, and I said, do you want it painted black? And he thought about it, and he said, maybe. I said, well, what if we ebonized it so you could still see the grain, and it'd be black? And
so
we decided on that.
So Because I don't know anything. What's the difference between ebonizing and like a traditional stain?
Well, I mean, indie ink isn't actually ebonizing. Well, maybe it is. Stain and ebonizing are pretty much the same thing, but ebonizing is just a fancy word for making something black.
You get reamed by some ebonizing expert.
I know.
It's like, oh, no, you didn't. Oh, it is not the same.
Come at me, bro.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Because I use, whenever clients want like super, super dark stuff, like the black stools, for example.
Yeah.
I always use the Rubio pre-color because it's super easy to do. You can still see the grain through it. But people are always like, oh, how'd you ebonize that? And I'm always like, I don't know. Is that some fancy thing? I just don't know what that is. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Blake, do you have any idea what ebonizing actually is?
I don't know the official term. I've never done that. It's something that I've thought about doing, but I was actually listening to the Modern Maker podcast today, which is another one of my favorites, and their entire episode was, well, most of the episode in the middle was talking about that specifically, and they were talking about different techniques like Shoshugiban and some of the other, or... Which,
but that's just lighting on fire.
I think I actually pronounced that wrong. I think they corrected themselves in the middle of that episode. I think it's Shushugiban, I believe.
I call it briquette.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I call it job security at my fire department job. So.
I wonder how many shops have been burnt down because people are attempting
to
do.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of Shoshugiban houses in my line of work. So it could be a good thing or a bad thing depending on how far you take it. But no, they were talking about that and a lot of different ways of either staining or ebonizing, and they talked about India ink and what was the other one? The one that they kept coming back to was the India ink as sort of the most consistent, easiest results and easy to get a consistent finish too. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
So you put the stuff on there, Nick, and then do you have to put a finish over the top of that, or is it done?
Yeah. So I'll be spraying lacquer on top. Okay. So I'll probably put like two or three coats of lacquer on top. But apparently, the India ink goes on so smooth that you don't have to worry about blotchiness at all. Like it just absorbs perfectly, and because it's black, it doesn't have any kind of strange blotchiness with pretty much every wood I've seen it put on. Everything from pine, maple, oak, even walnut, like it turns it black.
So it's something I've really wanted to try. Yeah, that's cool. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted. It should be a pretty cool project. So I've got that. I've actually have the India ink. I think it's scheduled to show up at my house tomorrow via Amazon Prime. I love Prime. But
is it coming from India?
I hope so. I mean, otherwise authentic. It's false advertising, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Authentic Indian ink.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So when are you hoping to have that all done?
Probably, well, if it depends on what time it shows up tomorrow. I might be able to get most everything stained up tomorrow. If not, hopefully by sometime next week or next weekend, something like that. But yeah.
Crazy.
I would imagine you'd have to be pretty careful with glue squeeze out with that kind of finish. So did you do anything like blue tape around the seams or anything where your joints came together to keep glue from getting on your wood?
I didn't tape anything up, but what I did was, since I was using pocket holes, I used minimal glue. I did like the Chris Salamone approach where I just used absolutely the most minimal amount of glue on all the joints. And then I used baby wipes to wipe up all of the seams.
Really?
Yeah. They're not really baby wipes because they're by a different company that I get and I leave them in the shop.
Disposable bath tissues.
Right.
I've never thought of doing that, but that's something that we have all over our house.
It's great. A buddy of mine in Canada, Ryan McDonald, he started using baby wipes like 2 years ago or something, and I've used them ever since I saw him using them, and it's been great.
What's
for
the
glue squeeze out?
Sorry to play like devil's advocate, but what's the benefit to that over just a wet rag?
Nothing. It's just they're available wet rags.
Convenience.
Yeah.
Like they're all. I mean, you have a pack of wet rags at your disposal.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean that. I don't think there's any benefit than a wet rag, but you just pull one out.
My mother-in-law's
and it's ready to
go. A wet rag. Low blow. Anyway,
is she listening to this podcast?
Definitely not.
She is now.
They don't have podcasts in hell.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
Maybe we should edit this part. Anyways, Blake, what are you working on, man?
Okay, so, well, mission accomplished. I went to the snow with the family. So
with the new truck.
Yeah, so got to go on a vacation. That's the main thing that I've been doing since we last talked, is relaxing, which is something that we definitely needed. It was a great trip, and the truck held up. So
did you get to use four-wheel drive?
A little bit. It didn't snow a ton when we were up there, so on the way home I put it in four-wheel drive just to test it out a little bit. I probably
is it on the fly? On the fly,
it is. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, you can just change it as you're going. So
nice.
Yeah, but I did get a little bit of shop time. One of the things that I did, I've been kind of prepping for this CNC machine to come, because like we talked about last time, this shop is tiny and there's not a whole lot of space. So I have to do, anytime I introduce something new, I have to pretty much redesign a portion of the shop. So that back countertop space that I was talking about, I kind of cleaned that out, and it occurred to me that I was going to need some kind of computer around to run the new CNC machine. And we actually updated our laptop last year. So I had this old MacBook Pro laptop that I bought, I think it was like a 2009 model. So it's an older one, but it still runs great.
Yeah, so, it's just getting broken in, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
low mileage.
Yeah, which you wouldn't think for a laptop. They don't usually last that long, but this one's it's been all right. So I built a little shelf, and I pulled this old computer monitor out of the attic that I had, and put together a little computer workstation in that back counter area, kind of cleaned it up. And I'm going to be putting some like dust protection around the little shelf that I put the laptop on. So, you know, at least it's not like a brand new computer. I don't have to worry too much about it. It was a computer that I wasn't even using, but I still want to keep the dust out as much as I can.
Keep it going
as much as possible.
Mine is super dusty.
Oh, your laptop or your computer area?
I just leave it right. I have it on a swing out arm right next to the CNC.
Yeah.
And it just collects dust. It's crazy.
I would imagine.
Is it like a laptop specifically for your CNC? It stays there?
Yeah, it lives on the CNC. It's just like Blake. It's an old MacBook of mine that I've just dedicated to the CNC. It's like, oh man, it's probably older than your MacBook, but it's one that you can't run unless it's plugged in. Like
that's the same here. Yeah,
the battery will
totally
not
shot.
Last. Yeah, so it's just plugged in, and it will live there until it dies.
Isn't all that stuff like sealed? I mean, dust, whatever.
Whatever. It's all flash memory, and it's fine. It's fine.
A little dirt never hurt anything.
Exactly. I mean, I figured it would be easier to just have a computer that was dedicated for that set up in the shop, especially since the whole idea behind a CNC, or one of the ideas, is that you can kind of start it and then do other things and multitask. So I figured if that's kind of running in the background, it's better to just have a little workstation. So I got that set up and cleaned out that area, and I posted on my Instagram stories a little bit of the process of this. It's always fun to kind of like reorganize or kind of update a little part of the shop. So been having fun with clearing that out and getting ready for the new toy, which I'm super excited about.
Yeah, you got a date on when it's going to show up?
No idea. I'm hoping soon. Every day has been kind of like waiting for Santa Claus to land on the roof, listening for the jingle bells. But I've been researching software. So one of the things that I found out is that you can do what's called 2D cutting with the software that's included with the machine, which means basically you can cut out shapes, but you can't do any kind of complex carving or like three-dimensional contours.
Yeah.
So, so I've been researching that a little bit, because that's really what I intend to do with it, is some more carving type projects and actual three-dimensional shapes.
Yeah, yeah.
Box tops or cabinet panels or that kind of thing. More organic.
Yeah.
Yeah, pizzas, like exactly.
Shop signs.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think project number one is going to have to be a pizza for sure. That's kind of.
That's going to be mandatory. $50. I'll pay you 50 bucks cash if you throw a pizza in that CNC.
Man, I'll do that.
I'm going to hold you to that. All right, sweet. 100 bucks right there. 50 bucks from each of you guys, right?
Yeah. That would be awesome.
All right, perfect. So,
yes.
I'll be able to put that money towards pizza cutters or whatever to go bits. I'll have to research that a little bit. What kind of bit is best for cheese and pepperoni?
Probably an upcut. I'd say an upcut.
Spiral down cut. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something thin, though.
All right. So, yeah, getting ready for that. And I've got some projects that I'm excited to tackle on that thing. So project number two is going to be pretty simple. My wife has, side story, my wife has a sticker, like art sticker business. So she's an artist and she creates like basically bumper stickers, but like really nice artistic ones. And she's starting to distribute those around town and around some of the other towns. So she's in need of some displays, like sticker holder displays. So that's like, she needs those yesterday. So that'll be a good kind of break-in project right after the first pizza cutter at the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
And that's only going to need the 2D software, because basically I'm going to do something that will kind of fit together like a almost like flat pack, but then you pull it apart and put it together as puzzle pieces so that we can send it to places.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Part two of why I brought up my wife's sticker business is that I wanted to give her a little plug because she designed our logo. So if you guys have seen our little headphones on the log logo, and you guys like that Craft Will Never Die logo, that's all her. So props to her for that. And go follow her on Instagram. She's Kat Weber Art. So there you go, honey.
That'll be $1,000.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll send you the bill.
This portion of the podcast is sponsored by my wife.
Shameless plug.
Very shameless.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's that, and that'll be project number two. And then I'm excited to get started on some like really interesting box tops or something. I have all kinds of. It's almost a problem of like. Dilemma of possibilities. There's too many things that you can do with a CNC machine, and you can just go nuts on it. But I'm trying to narrow it down to the things that will. I don't want to use the CNC machine as a way to build a project from start to finish, but I want to use it as an integration into something that I would normally build in my shop. So take kind of a woodworker's approach to using it just as another tool instead of. Looking at the CNC machine as like, this is what's going to make my next project.
Well, track with me on this, okay? You get the CNC machine. Maybe you use it to make a CNC machine.
And then
you take that CNC machine and you make another CNC machine.
Ooh. That's like woodworker inception right there.
And if each one of those CNC machines made another CNC machine... In 30 years, your house would be paid off.
And you'd have a lot of competition because I think there may be a few companies out there that are doing exactly that.
Yeah. No, but you're right. The possibilities are endless with those things. It's crazy.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned not using it to make a full project when I literally just posted my CNC making a full project. I had the CNC cut out an entire plant stand where. You literally
that's right.
You let it cut the whole thing and then you just put it together and you're done.
Yeah.
Plop, plop. That's it. That's the dream, right?
That's right.
I saw that and I like how you were like, I'm doing this now, but next time I'm just going to cut it myself on a bandsaw.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I said because.
That's the funny thing is with a bandsaw. It wouldn't be as perfect, but it would be so much quicker.
It'd be quicker, and I wouldn't have as much waste because with that design of that plant stand, I had like a 30-inch by 30-inch square of plywood that I threw away like probably two-thirds of it because you had to lay out the two pieces, and it doesn't make sense to use the CNC for stuff like that.
Well, I cannot wait to start wasting plywood by the dumpster full with my new CNC machine.
Well, have at it. I can't afford that.
No, I'm just excited. That's all. It's just a new toy and it's a new tool. It's going to open up more possibilities, but that's all.
Cool, man.
But I also, another thing that I did was I've had this joiner that I bought used on Craigslist, gosh, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I basically bought the joiner long before the wood shop was set up in the garage. And I actually stored it somewhere off site before I moved it into the garage. But I've never set the thing up. When I bought it, I took the blades off of it and brought them to a sharpener that we have here in town. And he sharpened the blades. And so they've actually been like, I pulled the blades out of a drawer the other day in my shop and they were still wrapped in like plastic and whatever that like rubber that they dip them in to keep the,
that's the
edges
best.
Sharp.
The maker's mark finish is what I call it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
So I pulled those out and, started setting up the joiner because I mentioned last time when we were talking about our shops, how I have this joiner below my miter saw station. I actually designed that thing specifically to have this joiner underneath it so that it would not take up so much space. But I needed a way to pull the joiner out to use it. And I found this old rolling tool base, one of those low profile rolling tool bases, also in my attic. This is just, I know I keep talking about all
how
these things
stuff
that I pull out of my attic.
How
big is your, why don't you just make your shop yeah. your attic?
How many bodies are in your attic?
I'm not going to talk about that on the podcast. No, but because it took me so long to set up this space, I had a lot of stuff stored in different places. And one of the places that I've had kind of odds and ends stored was up in the attic. So I went up there and found this rolling base and pulled it out. And the rolling base happened to be like the exact size. I mean, they're adjustable, right? You can add or remove the rails that kind of make it the dimensions, but I have no idea where the other rails are. So I couldn't have made it any bigger. And it just happened to be the exact size of the base of the joiner. So I put that on there and I can pull the joiner out, go to work on the joiner, push it back in. But then the other thing that I did was set the blades, which I didn't have a blade setting jig. So I kind of made one out of some steel rulers and some magnets, and that worked out great. But it was pretty rusty on the top of the joiner because this thing had been sitting around for a good 5 or 6 years without being used. And this is something that I've done before, and I knew that I was going to get flack for it, but I just took out my random orbit sander and started sanding the top of that joiner. I posted on Instagram and I knew that I was going to get some comments and like, oh my God, they were just flying with the troll comments.
What grit did you use?
40.
I think it was 320 or something like that. So it was pretty high grit.
It's like nothing.
But everybody was coming out of the woodwork saying, you've ruined this thing. You've destroyed it. It's never going to cut accurately.
What was their reasoning? Why is it ruined?
Well, apparently like the only right way to do it is by hand with a piece of steel wool and some WD-40 or something like that. But
in like 5 years time.
Yeah.
No, but I know. But what are they like worried is going to happen?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess because the idea is you're using like a power sander to sand the top of it, that you would just create divots or just because it's a machine surface.
I want these people's Instagram profile names because I want to go talk to them. It sounds like a lot of old guys. They probably just turn pens all day long. And my guess is they have nothing better to do than complain about someone using a sander on a joiner, because 320 grit, that's not going to do anything to the top of your joiner.
I'm going to post every single one of their Instagram handles in the show notes so everybody can run them out of town.
Yeah,
no,
we're
I'm
coming after them.
Do that.
Yeah, I'm coming at you. No, but seriously, that bothers me when people, I mean, there's things that I see people doing on Instagram that I'm like, yeah, you're doing that completely wrong and you're probably going to lose an arm or a finger or something and, you know, you shouldn't be doing it that way. But then there's just nitpicky stuff that's like, come on, guys, don't you have anything better to do than
it's that whole idea that that's the right way to do something or that's the wrong way to do something, and there just isn't.
Yeah, but according to who, that's the right way to do. Show me the book or the research you've done that says this is the definitive right way to do something.
Oh, careful with that, because I'm sure they will. But.
Yeah.
But where? But who? Okay, so you show me this book, but who published the book? I'm just saying, like, there's 10 different ways to skin a guinea pig, you know, and I've done 9 of them.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing is like, I'm not a machinist, and I'm not machining, you know, metal for the NASA, the next spaceship or something like that on this joiner. I'm a woodworker, and I'm taking off dimensions that are far less than what I would ever do with that sander and a 320 grit sandpaper to clean up the top. And you can see the machining marks on the top of this joiner, right? Like you can see sort of the swirly marks from when they machined that surface flat. And my whole philosophy is that as long as you're not sanding down through those machining marks, as long as you can still see those little grooves, then you're not going to be, you know, significantly changing the dimensions or the quote unquote flatness of the surface.
You'd have to hit that thing with a belt sander and let it sit
before
you did anything terrible to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, or like a sword forged in the fires of Mordor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
I got your back, Blake. I think you're fine, man. I've taken an orbital sander to the top of my table saw a couple different times to get rid of it. Because my problem is, I'm out in the shop, I'm working away, I'm busy, and I set my beer down on top of my table saw. And sure enough, it leaves a rusty water ring because it rusts so stinking quick. And even with like paste wax on there, it just happens. And so, yeah, I've taken an orbital sander to the top of my table saw a couple times. And it's, I'm sorry, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I do like 400 or 600 grit. And
yeah,
I just don't believe that that's going to change the surface of the machine enough that you're going to notice anything in your cuts or performance.
I agree. I've done it to the joiner. I've done it to the table saw. I've done it to my bandsaw. I have this problem where in the winter, whenever it rains, if I open my garage door when it's wet, it'll just rain on top of my table saw and my bandsaw. So that's something that I have to do. And I try to keep like a coat of wax on both of those so that they don't rust, but inevitably it happens a couple times a year. So I just kind of clean them up with a sander. It's quick. It's easy. It works fine. And again, like, anybody worried about the amount of metal that I'm going to take off doing that? I mean, you got to realize, like, once again, this is woodworking. I'm not a machinist. And the wood, even if you could cut it that accurately and that precisely, it's going to move. I mean, there's no way it's even going to hold to those dimensions at all. Not even close.
So, like, continuing on with this theme, because you bring up a really interesting point. Like, there's two kind of, like, sides of this argument. Some people are like, oh, we want to be as accurate as we can down to the thousandth of an inch on everything. And then there's other people that are like, you're not going to notice, you know, just make it look good to the eye. Where do you guys fall as far as that goes? Are you trying to get like perfect accuracy with your measurements, or are you on the other side of the line?
I tend to want to get precision and be as precise as I possibly can with stuff, but I know with this, what I have, I'm not exactly the most fine woodworker. I'm not making fine woodworking pieces either. I'm making like dining tables. I'm making benches. Like what I talked about, I'm making this coffee bar. I don't have to be, you know, dead on accurate to the 100,000th of an inch on things. I just need to make sure that it's going to be, you know, sturdy. It's going to look good to the eye. You know, cosmetics are going to be a big part. You know, if my stain doesn't look good, I think that's a much bigger problem than if I'm off by, you know, a 64th on a joint. So if I can get everything together and my seams are pretty tight, I'll be honest, the coffee bar I made, one of my cuts is just a hair off. I guess I might have pushed at the end of my cut through the table saw.
It's ruined.
Yeah, and it tailed off just a little bit at the back.
You got to Shoshib on that thing, man.
Well, I am. I mean, indie ink will hide all sins. I mean, if that thing is dark as night.
I think
night,
he means
then,
like bonfire. Is
yeah.
That what you meant? Like,
oh,
yeah. 100% Shoshugibon?
Yes. Dumpster fire.
No, go ahead. No.
As I was saying, like the one cut is just a little bit off on the back. But you can't really see it. And then on top of that, it's going to be inside of the cabinet that's going to be hidden by a drawer. So will anybody ever see that? No. So, I mean, I strive to be perfect, but a lot of times I think many people overthink how perfect everything needs to be.
Well, and even with like you look at traditional furniture and how that's built, you know, whether it's Shaker furniture or any of that stuff, they were producing that stuff in a practical sense, right? So like,
yeah,
there's all kinds of like dovetails that aren't perfect and joinery and cuts that are too short or not straight. And the other thing is like they were building all that stuff by hand, but it still lasts.
It's lasted the test of time.
It still lasts the test of time, exactly. And those guys knew what they were doing, and yet it's not perfect. But when you look at it, it's still beautiful and functional.
Well, and for me, since I'm doing completely like client work, that's all I do, okay? This isn't a part-time thing. It's a full-time thing. And so I have to find that balance of I want it to be good. I want it to be, you know, within a acceptable range for that my customers are going to look at it and be happy with it. But I can't spend the hours it takes to get things absolutely perfect all the time because I'm not going to make any money because my price point just isn't there.
Right.
If you look at somebody like Philip Morley, who's making crazy, accurate, perfect pieces of furniture, but his clientele is completely different than mine. He's got people that are paying like $60,000 for a desk.
Right.
Well, if I had people paying $60,000 for a desk, I could spend the time that it would take to make sure everything was absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
That's a really hard clientele margin to hit. And so I've, you know, tried to target a different clientele that's, you know, got a lower income level. And to do that, I have to be okay with some things not being perfect. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
So, Nick, what are some of the things that you do to kind of...
He said do-do.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah.
Nick, what are some of the things that you do to keep your woodworking as accurate as possible when you need to?
Well, I try my hardest to remember to check my machines before I use them. So I'll always break out like the woodpecker's squares and check my table saw, make sure the blade's at 90 because I don't trust the gauges on them. And I used to use one of those digital angle finders.
Oh, yeah.
I don't trust that thing anymore. Like,
yeah, I don't trust
really?
It at all.
No, I used it for a long time and it was okay. But then I started noticing that it was off a little bit. And especially after I got a woodpecker square, I would throw it up there after setting it with the Wixie and it would be off. And I was like, oh, that's not 90. So I just
better check mine because I rely on that thing constantly because my floor and my saw are not level. So I sort of have to.
Yeah, but then a little while ago, there was the whole debate of like somebody took a picture of a woodpecker square next to like their grandfather's square and was like, man, I've been using my grandfather's square and obviously it's not square. Look at the woodpecker square. And somebody commented and was like, well, how do you know the woodpecker square is square? And then it opened up this like Pandora's box
right.
of like, how do we know any square is square? And like, how do you test a square is square? And it like goes down this rabbit hole of like, that's where I'm like, if you're using a square, okay, and you call that square and you're squaring everything to that and you can't tell the difference, then if it's off a few thousandths of an inch, does it really matter?
No.
Well, but then there's this whole thing of like all these ridiculous people who think the world is round and then they have to like base their entire system off thinking that the earth is, you know, a sphere. I mean, that's just crazy.
Are you a flat
earther? Wait a minute.
One guy that was in like Nebraska trying to build a rocket to go up in the sky? Is that you, Blake?
I mean, I base all my measurements off the assumption that the ground is flat, so. Don't
what?
You? Doesn't everybody?
Oh gosh. You probably use the metric system too, don't you? No, but seriously, I think it gets to a point where it's just a little ridiculous and we all just need to calm down and take a breath and realize that if you can't stand back and look at something and determine with your eye whether it's square or not, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy DiResta has that saying, if it looks straight, it is straight. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
I would say 60 to 70% of the furniture I do is like, you know, new milled lumber. I'm going to the lumber store. I'm buying, you know, stock, white oak, walnut, whatever. And I'm trying to get it like absolutely perfect. But I'd say 40% of my business is working with reclaimed materials. And if you want to talk about not getting things squared, try building something with reclaimed wood, because it's a completely different ball game. You throw square out the window, and you're just trying to work with what you have available with your wood, because you're in this dilemma of you want it to be a good piece of furniture and you want it to be sturdy, but you can't mill things down and plane things down the way you could other wood, because you lose that patina. And so it's all about saving that history and that age and all that, like, you know, wear and tear on the board.
Right.
Well, you can't save that and get it perfectly square.
Exactly.
So you have to build it in a completely different way. And I mean, if you're anal about things being square, try and build something out of reclaimed furniture, and it'll change your view for sure.
Real quick. Yeah, the coffee table that I built recently out of reclaimed, I had to shim the legs to get them squared up so that it would sit flat, because I didn't want to flatten the top, both top and bottom, to where it would be flat for the legs, because then, you know, all the saw marks would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to keep it, I just ended up shimming it, and no one's the wiser.
Yeah. There's only, in my opinion, there's only one way to ensure perfection when it comes to reclaimed wood, and that is to do the restoration hardware method, which they do use real reclaimed wood, but what they do is they cut a tiny thin veneer, so they get all that character off the top, and then they laminate it onto an MDF substrate that they can make sure it's perfect.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're not a commercial business and you don't have the ability to do that, or you don't want to do that because you're dealing with, you know, MDF and stuff at that point, you have to be okay with things not being perfect all the time.
Right.
So, Jason, you do this for a living, so I know you've probably worked on both ends of the extreme, or at least for you. You talk about working with reclaimed lumber and not trying to be too precise with that. What would be an example of something that was on the other side of the scale that had to be very precise, and what are some of the things that you kind of do when you do need that precision?
Mm. So, yeah, it's funny because as much as I'm like, oh, reclaimed stuff, it's fine, it's close enough. When it comes to the other wood, I'm not anal like, you know, it's got to be within a thousandth of an inch or whatever, but I do like to try and get things as perfect as I possibly can. And so whenever I'm going to make like table legs or something like that, I do like to spend the time to try and make a jig or something that I can repeat things over and over again.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's just not as easy as setting up a stop on your chop saw and making sure that every, you know, cuts the same, because you tap into that stop with your piece of wood and it moves, you know, a little bit every time you cut it and it gets off. And so I use crosscut sleds and the table saw a lot to cut pieces. I think that's more accurate, in my opinion, than just using a chop saw, because I think you can clamp it down and kind of get the exact same cut over and over again. Things like that. I did one piece, oh man, this is probably a year ago. It was a walnut table, and the client showed me a picture. It was actually a table base that IZM Designs out of Canada did, and it's this crazy, it's hard to even describe through a podcast, but it's basically, you got to go look at my feet. It's this walnut table. It's got this crazy geometric base, feet going like every which way. There's no rhyme or reason to the angles, but as weird as it looks, it has to be absolutely perfect, or it won't sit right on the floor and the whole table will like wobble.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. And so the only way I could figure out how to do that was I basically had to make a mock-up of the entire table base out of fir 4x4s before I even cut my walnut 4x4s that I made to make sure that it was perfect. And I had to make a couple jigs and a cross-cut sled to get the angles just right. And it's a pain in the butt to get things perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, It's a pursuit, and sometimes you got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, I feel like I've done a lot of projects on both ends of, or both extremes on the spectrum. So I've done remodel work where you absolutely cannot obsess over the details, right? You gotta realize that like every step that you do in house construction is going to be covered up by the next step, right? So like the framing can't be perfect. It doesn't have to be perfect because it'll be covered by the drywall. The drywall doesn't need to be perfect because it'll be covered by the mud, and then the mud gets the paint, and then the paint gets the trim, and then, you know, the trim gets the caulk, and it just, it keeps
going.
Yeah,
but
going
you know,
that
every
way.
Step of the way, like the drywallers are like, those darn framers, they could have been a little more accurate. And the trimmers are like, those drywallers, they could have been.
Idiots.
You know,
yeah. And
they just pass it on down the line.
Exactly. And in my case, I did all of that myself when we did the remodel. So, it was important to kind of keep that in mind because as a woodworker, you can absolutely have a tendency to kind of obsess over the precision and the details all the way down to the framing. But I just have to keep remembering like this house also had to get done at some point. But on the other end of the spectrum, most of the stuff that I started out building in my woodworking was like jewelry boxes was one of the first things that I kind of started with. And that is an area where you actually do have to have quite a bit of high precision. So I did a lot in the early days to set my shop up for precision work. And that's one of the reasons, I mean, Incra, it's expensive, but I'm sponsored by Incra these days, but that's only recently. And that's only after I bought basically half of the products that they put out with my own money, you know, saving up one thing at a time and splurging over the years.
You didn't have those just sitting in your attic?
Yeah, I wish I could just go up there and pull
anything.
Maybe
she could check.
Maybe I should. Yeah. There's definitely certain types of woodworking that require a high level of precision. So some of the things that I do are like the ink is great, you know, but if you don't have that, things like setting up stops, one of the basics of accuracy is repeatability, right? So like anytime you can just take that time to set up a jig or set up a stop block or set up for repeatability and precision is just worth the effort.
Yeah.
You have to cut a bunch of intricate pieces for a jewelry box or something, then build a crosscut sled or build a jig that's going to allow you to do that repetitively and accurately so that at least they're all the same.
Yeah.
Those are the types of things that I look at when I'm doing small precision work, or even, you know, if you ever tackle sort of a fine furniture project or something that, especially in hardwoods, which hardwoods are not very forgiving. So you got to take that extra step to just set up for it.
Yeah.
And I don't spend a lot of time measuring in my shop. I barely use tape measures. It's all, for the most part, it's all relative measurements. So I know that this piece has to fit that piece. So I'll put them side by side and mark with a sharp pencil or a razor blade or something like that, you know, so just to be repetitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this reminds me of something I saw this week on Instagram. A buddy of mine that's local to me, Commonwealth Creations, Nathan, he had somebody post on his story about a jig that he made where they were saying jigs take away from craftsmanship. That
what?
if you have to use a jig, that you are no longer a craftsman, you become a factory, you become a robot, and that you should be able to repeat all of these things by your hand, and that, you know, you're no longer a craftsman if you use jigs. And I thought that was ridiculous, but I'd love to hear
that
what you guys...
That person turns pens on a lathe.
Yeah, I mean...
Sorry, I love all you pen turners. I'm just joking.
Yeah, we're not going to get any pens.
I could not disagree more.
No, I think that's crazy. I will say this. Whenever I make a jig to do something, if I have to make like multiple table legs and I make a jig, I never regret it. I'm super happy about it. Whenever I look at something and I'm like, I can just do that by hand, I almost regret it every single time. And I'm like, man, I should have made a jig.
Yeah.
Because, it takes longer to do, but it's more accurate. And I would poo-poo on that person's, like, it takes away from the craftsmanship. Because most jigs that I make for specific table bases, like, I'm having to invent that jig for the first time because it's for a very specific purpose for that specific table base.
Yeah.
At least it's new to me. And so I'm having to take the time to create it and figure out how it's going to actually work to make it do what I need to do. And that takes time and that takes creativity and that takes craftsmanship. So sure, I'm going about it in a different way, but that in no way takes away from the craftsmanship of that piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to look at somebody who's mastered the whole art of jig making for precision, it's, you know, Alabama Woodworks is, that's his whole thing there. Yeah.
That guy is a rocket scientist, both.
Literally
in the lab and in the workshop.
Yeah, and he does some pretty incredible work. You talk about precision and repetitive, you know, part making. He's making a whole set of chairs right now, and it's based on that whole principle. And I love that. I think that's absolutely, it depends obviously on what type of woodworking you're doing, but if you want a whole set of dining room chairs and you want them to match and look beautiful, then, you know, that's the way to go. Unless you want to spend 5 years basically reinventing the wheel every time and carving them by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, that doesn't make any sense either.
Yeah.
No, I would love to know what he's charging for those chairs. Because, again, like, it's a completely different realm. Like, Wee's an awesome guy. I've met him. He is an amazing woodworker. But he's got a full-time job. He works at NASA. He does crazy rocket science stuff. So he's not depending on his woodworking for his sole income.
Is he selling them, or is he making them for himself?
Oh, no, I think he is. Oh, I don't know what his price point is. But I'm just saying, like, woodworking's my full-time gig, and I just don't have that clientele base to spend that amount of time or precision. So for me, it's like the quicker I can get pieces in my shop finished and out the door, the more money I'm going to make.
Yeah.
I don't want to produce crap pieces by any means. I want solid, like, quality pieces, but I have to find that line of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable and find, like, you know, my profitability in that.
Yeah, you on everything that you make, you have to weigh the advantage of taking the time to make something that you can set up for repeatability and how much time is that going to save you versus am I only making one or two of these? Then, all right, I'll just, you know, measure the cuts and make the cuts that I need to make. You need to make 16 stools, then it makes a lot more sense to set up for that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I just don't make, all my stuff is pretty much custom one-offs, so even though I'm only doing it one time, it still makes sense to make jigs most of the time because it is more accurate. I know some people, they have like a furniture line, and so they're making the same piece over and over and over again. And then it definitely makes sense to make a jig because you're doing that repeatability. But even with the one-off nature of my business, I'm still making jigs all the time. Now, yeah. My jigs, I'm not making them in a way that they last a long time. I usually I literally super glue them together most of the time with fast drying super glue because I just need it to work for a short period of time and then I throw them in the trash. But
I saw that jig that you made for the table base. It was, remind me though, was it to center the way the base was going to be attached to?
For the pedestal.
That was brilliant. I mean, I that was a while ago, so I don't remember the details of it, but maybe describe that one to us.
Yeah, so it was a pedestal table base. So it's got, like, on the top and bottom, it's got two pieces that cross each other with a half lap joint. And then in the middle, you have like your pillar pedestal. And so, yeah, I just made a simple little jig out of plywood so that I could perfectly center that middle pedestal so that it was right in the middle of my top and bottom kind of cross pieces. But yeah, I just took plywood, I super glued it together, it was super quick and simple, and I made it in a way that I could get that centered, and then I actually locked the jig in between the top and bottom piece, so the only way to get the jig out was I had to actually break it to get it out, so that was
it. Man.
I used the jig one time.
It was a one-time use, but it was effective.
But it was perfect, and it was done, and it really didn't take me that long. So
yeah, do you have that? I know that was on your Instagram stories. Do you have that in a way to where people could still go and find it?
Yeah, that's actually one of the few YouTube build videos I've actually done. So if you go
that was
my
on
YouTube,
channel. Okay,
yeah,
oh, nice.
It's the white oak pedestal base. So yeah,
okay. I couldn't remember where I saw it, but I remember thinking, God, that is so cool. I mean, even though it's a one time use thing, you took the time to set it up so that you knew that it would be dead on.
Well, and if you're making jigs just for, like, one-time purposes, if you go to, like, Tight Bond or Star Bond products, those adhesive companies, they have their super glue and then they have their activator spray.
Yeah.
Those are money when it comes to making jigs because you put the super glue on, you do the activator, and you just have an instant jig.
Yep.
And Star Bond just decided to sponsor me, so I'm going to be playing with that stuff soon. I've never used it before, so I'm stoked.
It's good stuff.
Yeah,
good.
I've always seen everybody else using it. I was like, oh man, I got to pick up some of that stuff. And then they contacted me out of the blue. I'm like, oh, perfect.
Nice.
Yeah,
I've got,
yeah.
I'm, no, that's good. I'm touching Starbond fill right here on top of my desk. I filled a couple cracks with Starbond.
I'm touching fill too, but he's just this guy that sits in the closet while I record.
That's all I heard too. maybe TMI, but yeah, good thing this is a podcast, right? Not a YouTube video.
Yeah.
So we've, you know, dove really deep into this whole precision topic, which has been great. But before we run out of time here, I did want to bring up our new maker segment. Nick, what's it called again?
New maker. Who dis?
Who dis?
Who dis?
All right. So this is a guy that I met last November down in Austin at a Festool Ruby and Monaco event that I went down to, and he is an amazing woodworker. He is self-taught. He is doing incredible craftsmanship. I mean, I wish that I was on this guy's level. His name is Corey Morgan. His Instagram handle is Corey Morgan Woodworks. Corey is C-O-R-E-Y Morgan Woodworks.
I think I'm subscribed to him already. I gotta check
Corey,
it out.
Corey, did you say Corey with a C?
Corey with a C. He does a lot of stuff with live edge slabs. His background, he actually worked at a mill doing cutting and milling slabs for a long time. It was his family business, I believe. And then he broke off and he does his own furniture line now. And his stuff is just incredible.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's amazing.
This bench that has a live edge waterfall 45 degree. What is this crazy?
It almost looks like a giant paper airplane. It's crazy.
It doesn't even make sense. And if you see where that bench wound up, it wound up next to a staircase, and the angle on the back of that bench perfectly matched the angle of the staircase.
Oh, man.
So it fit it fit perfectly. His stuff is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And he is not getting the recognition that he deserves for his level.
Oh, no, this guy's on another level.
Yeah, go follow Corey Morgan Woodworks. His stuff's amazing.
Yeah, I have actually been following him for a while, and you had to remind me who he was, but he is absolutely incredible.
And he is literally the nicest guy I have ever met in my entire life. I'm not just saying that. He is the nicest guy, and he's got 500 children.
Here's a picture of at least 4 kids in one picture.
Yeah, he's got a lot of them. They're just always crawling in and out of his pieces of furniture. So anyways, he's a really cool guy. Go follow his stuff.
It's incredible. Morgan, I mean, he does everything from really intricate detail stuff to gigantic slab work.
Oh yeah. No. And just crazy, crazy stuff. So,
wow.
Very cool. Well, should we close this thing out and call it a night?
Yeah. I'm ready to hit the hay.
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to say is, I have been absolutely blown away by all the support on this podcast. I mean, we're recording episode 3 right now, but after the first 2 episodes, I mean, have you guys seen all the shares and all the reposts and everything? I mean, it's been just the coolest audience ever. It's been going nuts.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
I don't know if you guys have noticed that, but it is mind-blowing for sure.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to take a minute to acknowledge that and how much we appreciate that. Everything helps right now because we're just getting started. So the momentum has been awesome. We're having a great time. We're having a lot of fun. And every time somebody shouts us out or even just gives us feedback on Instagram is kind of the main platform we have for that right now. But also, Nick, you were kind of saying that reviews help quite a bit. How does that work?
Yeah. So on iTunes, if you guys head over to iTunes and give us a review, if we're worthy of a 5-star review, we would appreciate it. And if you want to,
which we are,
yeah,
we are.
Oh, we definitely
if
are.
You're not going to give us a 5-star review, don't even bother, just walk away. keep walking.
Yeah. But if you want to leave us a couple notes about what you like about the show and all of that, really helps us as we're new on iTunes, and that pushes our show up into the ratings, and that would be just really greatly appreciated.
Yeah.
Let me just say something real quick. If you don't give us 5 stars, I've got 5 fingers that make a fist that have something to say about it. Sorry, that was just put that in really loud in people's ears.
I know where you live. Yeah, I know your Instagram handle. I will find
you. No, the support has been amazing. We absolutely love all of the listeners.
It has
so far. So
yeah.
Keep it up, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. From the bottom of our hearts and our wood piles, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
from the pile of my stools,
yeah.
We thank you.
All right, guys, it's good talking to you again. And thank you, everybody, for joining us again this week. We really do appreciate all the feedback we've gotten on Instagram and our social media accounts. But don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. It really does help get the word out there and help us grow this podcast. Have a good week, and we'll see you later.